It's 5:06. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Gene Purcell. I'm here today filling in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll be hearing a story about the state of Wisconsin leading the Midwest in small business survival rates. Now, you might think this is good news, but we've got an expert from the Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance discussing this and the small business climate in the Badger State. And the fact is that that story is a little more complicated than that. That the reason that we have small businesses with a high survival rate is because not as many businesses start here in Wisconsin. So, something to think about.
That's right. Apparently, we have a risk-averse mentality here in Wisconsin when it comes to starting businesses. People are cautious. Bankers are cautious. And as a result, people are not starting businesses, but people are starting businesses, those that do, and they are sticking around for more than 10 years. The survival rate is good.
Yeah, it's interesting. So, it's very much a mixed blessing there, the idea that if you start a business in Wisconsin, that chances are good, and I think it's somewhere around 50% over the course of 10 years, chances are pretty good that it's going to stick around. But that idea of entrepreneurship, that idea of taking a risk, that idea of sort of taking a chance and seeing what happens, doesn't always happen here in Wisconsin, and that is one of the real interesting angles in this story today from the Midwest and small business survival rate.
And we'd like to know what you think. Have you considered starting a business in Wisconsin? And if you haven't decided to go ahead and do it, but you've got that idea niggling in the back of your head, what has held you back? What has held you back from starting a business in Wisconsin? Is it the caution thing? Is it a Wisconsin culture of caution? Or is it something else? Let us know what it would take to encourage you to take the leap and start a business. You can comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
Yeah, the Central Time Facebook page is a great place to make that comment and think about that climate for a while. You know, is it really that conservative in Wisconsin? Or do we have a lot of risk takers? We certainly hear about a lot of businesses that have become very, very successful. Is this the place? Again, our Central Time Facebook page is the place where you can leave a comment on that topic.
Right now, after 40 years with Wisconsin Right to Life, 27 of them as their executive director, Barbara Lyons is retiring.
During her tenure, the organization saw its growth in stature. It became an influential force in the public debate over abortion rights.
Barbara Lyons is with us today. She joins us from our studios in Milwaukee. Barbara, welcome to Central Time.
With you and the audience this evening. Thank you so much for this opportunity.
Well, today, Wisconsin Right to Life is billed as one of the nation's most powerful anti-abortion groups. Why was your group so successful?
First of all, we have a range of issues. I know that we're most well-known for the abortion issue, but we've been equally active in the areas of assisted suicide, euthanasia, and stem cell research. But again, we have a large body of work in the abortion area, and I think that we've been successful mostly because of the commitment of those of us that have joined together to form Wisconsin Right to Life at every level of work that we do, from making a simple phone call to raising funds to passing very significant legislation to working on election campaigns. We've done it all. We have felt that our mission could only be accomplished if we addressed these issues in a very complex and comprehensive way, and we have set out to do that, and I believe we've been successful.
I'm curious. I want to try to draw a parallel here. Oftentimes with Supreme Court justices, there's speculation that the judges strategize the time that they step down to coincide with the time when the winds of politics are blowing their way. Is that perhaps true of you? Are you stepping down at this time because you feel the tides on the abortion debate are turning in your favor?
I do believe they are turning in our favor, but this has been an anticipated move. We've been discussing it for 2 or 3 years. I'm now 73 years of age. I'm in extremely good health, but I do not want to leave an organization in chaos should my health falter or other circumstances prevent the organization from going forward in a very successful manner. So I am pleased that I believe that the wind is at our back, particularly in regards to the influx of young people into our work. We are just so inspired and so thrilled to have their participation, and I think it bodes well for our movement for the future. We also know that technology has driven people to our side of the debate. It's just silly at this point to talk about an unborn child being a blob of tissue or a clump of cells when ultrasound tells us differently. So we have many, many things moving in our favor as we go forward into the future.
What are you proudest of when you look back at your career with Wisconsin Right to Life?
Because I became involved as a young mother with four small children, and I never anticipated or dreamed that this would be my life's work, and it really truly has. Of course, my family comes first, but this is a body of life's work. And I would say that the most important thing, the things that I savor the much, are the individual lives that have been impacted by our work. You know, we know that there are literally hundreds of thousands of people that are alive today because we cared to educate their mothers, their families, about the value of life and the fact that each person has value regardless of their circumstances, regardless of their level of ability, and that it's important that we as a society and as a family recognize that. So again, knowing that there are people literally walking the streets today because of our work is really the most satisfying.
And what would you look back and say was your biggest failure?
Our biggest failure is that it's 40 years and we still have abortion on demand. We still have the gravest human rights abuse in our country's history that is alive and well at this particular time. That's very, very difficult to contemplate. I can still remember the 10-year period after Roe versus Wade. I remember thinking this was just a very silly decision by seven individuals who just did not understand the realities of life in the womb, of what is constituted in a, you know, what happens in a pregnancy, and that if we just educated people, we could turn it around in 10 years. And yet at the 10-year period, I think that was, in my mind, the lowest period for me personally, because I felt that we had done our utmost to say this is a wrong decision. These are the facts. These are the realities. These are the people that are being impacted. We have to stop this violent action. And it instead was going in the other direction. So, again, I would say that would be the length of time that it's taken to correct this wrong, both legally and from a human rights standpoint, is probably the biggest disappointment.
Abortion is one of the truly hot button issues in this country. And there are people just as passionate as you about women's right to reproductive choice. So the other side there, what is it like? What has it felt like to work on that fault line?
And I haven't let it impacted me personally. I just feel that you work with facts that you have and realities that you face, and you put those forward in the most positive and compassionate way that you can. And you fight really hard. If you want to talk about one of the reasons we've been so successful, it's tenacity. We just don't quit. We essentially look at challenges and struggles, and we maybe are reluctant to move forward, but we say, no, this is important. Lives depend on our ability to move forward. And so we have that tenacious attitude. But I don't wish any ill will to people on the other side of the issue. I just think they're flat wrong.
I want to talk to you a little bit about the Hobby Lobby decision that just came down from the Supreme Court on a couple levels. When it comes to contraception and abortion, some have seen the debate on the national level as sexist. They've said it's a sexist thing because it affects women. And on the other hand, Hobby Lobby is not now required to pay for birth control or abortions, but it will still pay for things like vasectomies, for instance. How do you respond to that criticism that this is the anti-birth control and the anti-abortion aspect of this is tantamount to sexism?
I think that's a small portion of the debate. And truly, the true sexism in this issue is when we abort girls simply because they are not the desired sex. So they're not allowed to exist simply because they're girls. That's the real sexist issue that we face at this particular time. And there are much larger issues that we faced over the years, such as partial birth abortion, the whole Gosnell dilemma, when we were faced as a nation with this monster, literally, who was committing horrible acts on mothers and unborn children. And when you look at the sheer numbers of abortions that have been performed, some 56 million as of the legality, I mean, those are really the key issues. These others are just small issues that people like to talk about that are really not that impactful.
Well, you've been critical of the Hobby Lobby decision, saying it's nowhere near enough to correct the heart of the problem. What do you see as missing from the ruling?
The Hobby Lobby issue does not address the overall problem with the Obamacare law, and that is that it has many, many facets that have abortion as a part of it. And I think that's a much larger problem, and the Hobby Lobby decision, again, addressed a very narrow issue, a very important but a very narrow issue, and did not take on the larger issue of taxpayer funding of abortion within Obamacare, either directly or indirectly, and also what we could view in the future under some of the regulations that go along with that law. The other thing that the Hobby Lobby decision did not do, it did not address the rationing part of Obamacare, which is impacting right now and will significantly so in the future our older people and people with disabilities. They're the ones that are going to be individuals who lose health care simply because it's too expensive or someone deems it to be too expensive.
We're talking right now with Barbara Lyons, retiring executive director of Wisconsin Right to Life, about her tenure and the future of the pro-life movement in Wisconsin.
And we invite you to join the discussion as well. What questions or thoughts do you have for Barbara Lyons? Have you noticed a shift in the public dialogue about right-to-life issues in Wisconsin over the past few decades? And how do you feel about where that conversation is going and the legislation that might be coming out of it? Get in touch with us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email us at talk@WPR.org.
We'll be back with Barbara Lyons right after this check of the latest headlines with Kristen Durst.
This is Central Time. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're hosting an exit interview with Barbara Lyons of Wisconsin Right to Life. She retires from her post after serving 27 years as their executive director and building the group into a national force.
And we'd like to hear from you, too. How do you feel about where the discussion, where the conversation on public dialogue on right to life issues has been going in Wisconsin? What about legislation in the state? Get in touch with us at 800-642-1234. Or if the phone lines are full, send us an email, talk@WPR.org.
And Barbara, I want to talk about the way abortion rights, that dialogue has progressed in this country. When the term single-issue voter is used, a lot of the time it's used to describe people who vote either against abortion or in support of a woman's reproductive choice. Is it beneficial, do you think, to society when a single issue like this drowns out so many other issues?
It's a sign of a vibrant democracy that people can decide for themselves how they want to vote and the reasons for which they vote that way. So I don't see it as a problem at all. I don't think any voter essentially doesn't take in other issues into consideration, but they may have a bottom line, and I think that's democracy at its best.
Do you think that when you're considering the issue of abortion, is it to you primarily a religious issue?
No, it never has been. It's a human rights issue. It has no other basis or underlying philosophy except that there are human beings that are affected by these issues, the life issues, which encompasses more than abortion, that we have as a society said that there are some human lives that are expendable if others around them believe so and give them the opportunity and the legality to end their lives. And that's just a basic human rights issue. It transcends any other philosophy or religion.
I'm going to go to our callers now. We have Steve joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Steve.
Hello. I would like to say this. Before abortion was legal, we lost thousands of women a year because they were in religious families. They would be ostracized. They were raped by incest. They were raped because so many young men, it's a thing of pride for a young man to sleep with as many women as he can and to lie to them to do anything. And when they say no, that means yes, don't you know, that, according to them. And they all have sex with these girls. Now the girls are stuck. They've got this child and they don't know where to turn. Our social system has cut them off. We cut everything. The Republicans just cut out my re-education, veterans re-education. They cut out anything for the poor. They won't tax the rich.
All right, Steve, I'm going to jump in there and get Barbara's response. But what about the first part of Steve's call about the lives that were lost prior to the legalization of abortion because of unsafe practices?
First of all, those number of those lives are exaggerated. I am not going to justify the loss of any life, but the numbers are exaggerated, and that's proven by the Centers for Disease Control own statistics. So for the other instances that Steve talked about, I just don't have any basis for factual or reality for what he said. I think that's an opinion. I don't think it's borne out by facts, and I appreciate the fact that he's commented on it, but I don't have a response to it because I don't think it's reality.
Are you worried about the role, the choices that women have being narrowed so that they have less agency in their own lives and control over their own bodies?
That's interesting, Veronica. It's really an interesting question, because when Roe versus Wade was the fiat that was essentially put upon our country, the arguments were, you know, absolutely a dream world. We weren't going to have any unwanted children. Child abuse would disappear. Poverty would disappear because people would only have the children they wanted. And yet we have seen a dramatic turn in the other direction with the social problems that were supposed to be solved by abortion on demand. So I think, again, the facts are very clear that abortion has not solved these problems. Many of them are worse at this particular time. I think that women in this day and age are left without support systems simply because abortion isn't out. And I don't want to essentially chastise men totally. But I think that a lot of the situations you see when a woman becomes pregnant is that the man says, it's your decision. And what that essentially says to her is, I'm not going to support you. And I think she's left without those support systems, not from government, but from the people around her. We've also seen a rise in forced abortions where the woman is told, you will do this or else, either by family members, mother, father, or by boyfriend. And lots of instances of people who have essentially killed their pregnant woman because she wouldn't have an abortion, or beat them up, or whatever. So this has not been a boon for women whatsoever. And I say that as a woman, and I say that as someone who is just, I just am aghast that this has happened to women by an action that supposedly was supposed to help them.
This is, to say the least, it's a polarizing issue, a very polarizing issue. Do you think people on both sides of the divide will ever be able to work together towards preventing unwanted pregnancies so that abortion becomes less and less necessary, especially in cases, you know, like you're talking about, or rape or incest?
I think that some of that is happening right now. We've seen a dramatic reduction in the number of abortions, particularly in our state, in Wisconsin. It's been quite dramatic, something that we certainly are very proud of, because it means that more women are choosing life for their children. So in terms of getting together, I don't know what that would look like. You have the providers of abortion that feel that they have to essentially do more of what they're doing, and of course we disagree with that.
Let's go back to our phones. We've got Duncan joining us now from Waterford. Hi, Duncan.
Hi. So my question was just that I was wondering, you mentioned earlier for the Right to Life group that about your stance on stem cell research. And I understand the human rights issues with abortion, but I'm curious as to your opposition about stem cell research.
All right. Thank you, Duncan. And Barbara, what's the grounds on opposing stem cell research?
What a great question. When we went down the path of embryonic stem cell research, I think people have to understand that it's all based upon the destruction of a living human embryo. So you're taking a person, a live human being, and you're essentially destroying them for their stem cells. But I think that what we've seen where we are now is that most scientists are pursuing ethical stem cell research, of which there are very many varieties. There's adult stem cell research, which essentially involves taking cells from a person and programming them and putting them back in the person, which has benefit for the individual because it's their own cells being put back into them, and no one has to die to retrieve these cells. But then we also have the advent of the induced pluripotent stem cells in 1972, which has given scientists a new way to create these cells that in a very ethical way, which have the same or very similar propensities as the embryonic. And again, it's very, very ethical. And you really see science moving down the ethical path at this particular time. And that's, again, another thing that we've done that I feel is very, very important in terms of helping to turn that debate in the right direction. And everybody wins. You know, there's no ethical concerns. The ethical stem cell research is better for the patient. It can be more patient-specific, and it's cheaper. So it's a win-win all the way around. We're very proud of that.
And Barbara, we've got about 30 seconds, but what do you expect to see on the agenda for Wisconsin Right to Life in the upcoming months with a new director?
I think our staff is really becoming very young. We've had 6 people retire this year, and that's quite a relatively small staff, that's quite a large number of people. And the new individuals on staff are very young, so they're going to come with young ideas, enthusiasm, more technology-based, using all of the essentially resources out there to promote the message. And I am very excited about that for the future. I mean, we've done some of that with our older staff, but I think we're going through a seismic age change that's going to be very, very bright for our future at Wisconsin Right to Life.
Barbara, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for this opportunity, and thank you for all opportunities to be on WPR shows over the years. I've really enjoyed it.
That was Barbara Lyons, Executive Director Emerita of Wisconsin Right to Life. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell, in for Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And coming up on Central Time, we'll talk to a food preference expert about why our tastes change as we get older.
First, we're focusing on some news from the U.S. Small Business Administration. According to their state profiles, Wisconsin has the highest rate of small business survival in the Midwest.
Wisconsin's small business survival rate is also higher than the national average. And while this may seem like good news about Wisconsin's economy, there is more to this story.
Dale Knapp joins us now. He's the research director for the Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance. Dale, welcome to Central Time.
Glad to be here.
So when it comes to startups in Wisconsin, there has been some iffy news, but this seems to be one thing Wisconsin is doing right. The businesses that start up are surviving. They're doing pretty well. What do you make of this?
Yeah, well, it's something that we've written about a couple of times, that Wisconsin's sort of different from a lot of states in that, one, as you mentioned, we have this relatively high survival rate. So after 10 years, typically about 40 to 41% of those new startups are still around. The national average is only about 34%. So we do much better than the national average, much better than most states. The other side to that coin, though, is that we don't start very many small businesses. When you look at new firm creation, we're typically in the bottom 10 states in the country. So we don't start many, but those that we start tend to do pretty well.
It's an interesting kind of dichotomy there. What do you make of the fact that we're not starting more businesses?
Well, it's something that we've pondered for quite a while now. And in talking with people around the state and people that are involved in starting businesses, it seems to come back to an economically conservative attitude, that we're a little bit more cautious in the kinds of firms that we're going to start up. We want to make sure that there's a good chance that they succeed. So we seem to be a little bit more risk averse than of some other places. And we've also heard that from people that have started their businesses or are running small businesses, they seem to believe that the financial system, bankers, et cetera, are much more risk-averse here. And so they're not willing to finance riskier startups. They're willing to finance the safer ones. And so that seems to play a role in it. And you look at our venture capital numbers, the last numbers that we have, Wisconsin gets about $34 per worker in venture capital, the money that these startups rely on. Nationally, the average is over $200. So there's not a lot of risk capital coming into the state either.
So Wisconsinites or the entrepreneurs in Wisconsin are more cautious. Sounds like the banks are more cautious as well. Where do you think that tone of caution comes from?
Well, some would say that it's really historic. It's the types of of people that, that settled here, the Germans from Europe, the Norwegians, they tend to be, when they got here, they tended to be more blue-collar, you know, very risk-averse. And unlike many other states, we don't leave the state. So, you know, many other states, they may have these, you know, established by Germans as well, but they have, there's a lot of turnover. There's a lot of people that leave the state and come in. When you look at census data, we tend not to leave the state, and very few people come to the state, so we still have that really strong German Norwegian heritage here, which I think still plays into it somewhat.
So you're saying is, as a state character, maybe we are just naturally more cautious, and that might just be what it means to be from Wisconsin to a certain extent.
That might be, and there's, you know, there is an upside to that. We seem to get hit you know, less by big recessions. To generally, you know, the financial crisis hit us a little bit less than other places. You know, housing market did not do as poorly here as some other places. So there's some good in being conservative. On the other hand, when you look at the numbers, those states that tend to have fairly high firm creation rates, whether or not they survive a long time, those are the ones that tend to have higher job growth. And the reason seems to be that they, you know, by creating a lot of firms, they tend to hit the big ones. They hit the home runs, essentially. And so, you know, they get the Microsoft or they get the Dell computer, those kinds of companies that we don't necessarily seem to get as much.
Does the survival rate also speak to the levels of support that we have in Wisconsin for new businesses?
It may, but, you know, we've not seen anything that would indicate that we're vastly different from other states in that regard. So, you know, there can be a lot of things that are playing into this, but, you know, it seems to come back to just this risk-averse nature to some degree that we tend to have.
Well, what do you think we need to do as a state to overcome that risk-averse nature and get people taking more chances on business?
Well, you know, again, I do think that, one, we need to, you know, really find ways to attract those kinds of entrepreneurs here. That's one thing, you know, and find ways to attract the financing for them. You know, there are organizations out there that are working on the venture capital side to try to get those dollars in here for those companies that would be a little bit riskier. But I think, you know, sometimes it just pays to get lucky. I think, you know, Epic is a good example. Epic and Madison, they do medical records, had been around as a small business for a long time and really sort of hit it at the right time around 99, 2000 and has exploded. And so it's something that in the Madison area has really built off of that. And so, you know, we need to find ways to fund those kinds of businesses that, you know, at the time might have been a little bit risky because, you know, when it was established, it was unclear whether there was going to be a big market for this. It happened to work out. So bringing in the capital, bringing in the human capital, the young entrepreneurs, that's going to be the way to do it. And you look at our migration numbers, bringing in the young entrepreneurs is going to probably be a bigger challenge than bringing in the capital.
Now, we hear a lot of times that most new businesses fail. It's a hard thing to succeed at. Do these numbers about survival rates for new businesses in Wisconsin mean that Wisconsinites should take heart and maybe this is a pretty good climate to start a good business that will survive, you know, longer than the average?
I think they should. I mean, I think, you know, the numbers, you know, indicate that you know, our overall business climate is probably pretty good for small businesses. You know, we generally do, as it shows, pretty well. But as sort of as we go forward, you know, we want to be a state that's to some degree, you know, leading in terms of job growth, in terms of the new economy. We can't rely on the manufacturing as we have in the past, because we know those kinds of jobs are struggling to grow. So trying to find what our niche is in terms of the ever-changing economy, and nurturing those kinds of businesses can go a long way to creating an economy that is going to prosper over the next 10, 15, 20 years.
Dale, thanks a lot for joining us.
All right, glad to be here. Thank you.
We've been talking to Dale Knapp, Research Director for the Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance.
Coming up next. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Jean Purcell.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. When I was a kid, I used to hate avocados, but now I can't imagine life without guacamole. And apparently I'm not alone. A lot of us experience a broadening of our taste preference as we get older, and we like stuff that we used to hate when we were kids.
Well, that goes for some of you. Some of us like exactly what we liked when we were kids and nothing else. Marcia Pelsha is with us today to talk about this topic. She is a sensory scientist at the Monell Chemical Senses Center. Marcy, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thank you.
Let's start with the basics. What is it about being a little kid that can really make them be a picky eater?
It's actually normal for children to be picky compared with adults. Picky eating involves eating an especially narrow range of foods, and kids, generally do not enjoy all of the foods that adults do. But children who are picky eaters might be extremely, extremely narrow and maybe only eat 5 or 10 different foods. When that happens, people become concerned about their nutritional well-being, although, in fact, most of the time, kids are getting a balanced diet and their weight is normal. It's just more of a social problem.
If we look at this from, an evolutionary point of view, it seems like it would benefit kids if they ate more stuff, that they'd be more likely, 200 years ago, 100 years ago, to survive. So why is it that kids would be pickiest when they're little?
Well, it is true now that we have a fairly safe food supply that, it would be better to have a more varied diet, it would be more balanced. But, back in caveman times, at least, the average age of weaning was around 2, and children would begin eating on their own then. And at that time, there were lots of things around that were poisonous, and it was better for them to, just sample a little bit of a food or just to eat what they saw older members of their group eating, and to gradually build a wider repertoire of foods.
So these days, when do kids start to get out of this phase of being picky, and how do you get the data on that?
Of course, we would love to do longitudinal studies, follow the same children throughout life. Nobody funds that kind of research, including the federal government, unfortunately. But by studying children at different ages, at looking at their reactions to foods in the laboratory, observing them in naturalistic settings, scientists can begin to get an idea of what happens. And probably the peak of pickiness is around 2 or 3 years of age. Although, unfortunately, that's also the time that kids are likely to go under the sink and swallow something poisonous. You've got the worst of both worlds. There are certain times when kids become a little more independent of their parents, when they start kindergarten, when they go to high school and start going out with their friends, not with their parents, when they go away to college, that their food experiences can really broaden. It's been shown with college students that if you give them successful experiences with new foods. You find unfamiliar foods that actually taste good, and, you know, you give them four or five of those. The next time you offer them a new food, they are more willing to try it.
Right. That's what you hear as a new parent. I'm a parent of young kids, and what I heard was that if they don't like it and they reject it and they spit it out and make that face, you should just present it again, that you should present the food maybe four or five times before you really put it on the will not eat list. Is there anything to that?
As a matter of fact, with my kids, I never put things on the do not eat list. I mean, I unfortunately did a paper on the odor that asparagus creates in urine. It's a very scientific paper and important, but nevertheless, my daughter heard me talking about this when she was a young child, and has refused for many years to even try asparagus. Now that she's 16, she is finally willing to try it, although she doesn't quite admit that it's wonderful yet. My son really didn't eat eggplant, which admittedly is a difficult vegetable. When cooked properly, it's sort of grayish-brown and mushy, but, you know, it can be delicious, and many adults love it, and so it really wasn't until he was out of college that he liked eggplant. So I say never give up. I didn't force these foods on them after a while when I realized they didn't like them. They were always required to come up with a nutritionally appropriate substitute for foods that they didn't eat.
Wow.
And that taught them nutrition, and it was quite inconvenient for them when they were little and didn't cook and couldn't reach things. But, you know, they could go get some baby carrots or, you know, whatever out of the refrigerator, and that was fine. And now both of them eat just about everything.
You know, earlier you said that a lot of times you see these changes at certain times in a child's life when they're becoming independent of their parents. And what sorts of things do they explore at those times? Do they just sort of rebel against the parents, or are they just more open to trying something else, whatever it might be?
Well, a big factor is peer pressure. They see other kids eating kiwis, and even though they might never have eaten a kiwi, if other kids say, oh, they're really good, you know, they do become more willing to try them. And then, of course, when they get older, it's embarrassing to go out to a Chinese restaurant with friends and not be able to eat anything with hot pepper in it. And, you know, dating, you certainly don't want to go on a date with someone and have to just eat rice and meat on a stick.
So in other words, if you're going to be a sort of a flexible person in society, you have to be able to embrace a variety of circumstances and a variety of foods.
Yes, and there are picky eating children who grow up to be, well, they call themselves selective eaters. And one of the things that bothers selective eaters the most is that they're limited socially. They can't go to someone's house for the weekend or go to a business lunch. They have to say, I'm not very hungry, or I had a stomach bug, I'll just eat some bread or something like that. So it is difficult. Eating is a very social activity for humans.
Could part of this be that kids just taste things more strongly than grown-ups do? I can remember when I gave my son his first avocado, and he had a full-body grimace, writhing reaction. It seemed like a very strong reaction. It seemed like he was tasting more than maybe an adult would.
Well, you know, it is surprisingly difficult for us to really know. Yes, children do seem to have a big bigger reaction to things that they put in their mouths. And then they, you know, once they've gagged on something, they seem to be worried that that's going to happen again, and that keeps them from trying new things. But the question is, did they really feel it more strongly, or is it just that for them, at an early age, everything is unfamiliar? And all other things being equal, people like familiar foods better than unfamiliar foods. So, yeah, it was sort of a ghastly experience, but, you know, maybe it's hard to tell whether the sensory experience is actually stronger. Another sensory part of flavor that people tend to neglect is smell. And, of course, for avocado, there's not much of a smell. Broccoli is, you know, a vegetable that many people reject. And it's often said that it's because it has a bitter taste and maybe children sense it as being more bitter. But, you know, broccoli contains sulfur compounds. And when it's cooked, that smell, that rotten egg or rotten vegetable smell is released.
And I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there, Marcy. We're out of time. But thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, it was a pleasure.
We've been talking with Marcia Palsha, sensory scientist at the Monell Chemical Senses Center.